Hello and welcome to another episode of Galactic Chat. I'm David McDonald, and tonight I have the pleasure of welcoming the wonderful Karen Warren. How are you doing, Karen?
Great, thanks, David. How are you?
Not too bad. It's great to have you here. I've got lots of questions for you, lots of exciting stuff to talk about. So I thought what we might do was I just wanted to start out and ask you if you could tell us a little bit about your writing journey. Where did you start, and what got you on the road to stardom?
Stardom. I'm still on that road, Dale. Well, it's been a long time, actually. I published my first story 21 years ago. So I've been working pretty solidly getting published stuff ever since then. But before that, it took 5 years from me deciding I wanted to be published to me first being published. And that was when I first started actually sending stuff out. And before that, really from the age of 14, I was writing short stories and novels and thinking that it might be an idea that I might be able to pursue, I suppose. But at that age, it's much harder to pursue it, I think, isn't it? You haven't got the resources, and I didn't have the money to mail things out, and it was even as basic as getting, I had to go to, save up my money to photocopy my novel so that I could send that off, that kind of thing. So that sort of stuff is tricky when you're a 16 and 17-year-old, I guess.
So can you remember your first acceptance?
I can, very clearly. I even remember, I was actually standing in the same place that I was standing when I got the news about that when the Princess Diana died. It was the same spot, the phone in the same spot, and my mother had called me about Princess Diana. So it was, standing at the kitchen bench. It was not long after we'd moved to Canberra. And, they hadn't been able to find me because we'd moved, and I thought I'd sent a forwarding address, but they didn't have it. And then somehow, I think I'd sent them a letter to chase up on this story, as you do, when you've been waiting a while for an acceptance, you send off a polite note to say, oh, just making sure that you've got my submission. And they called me and said, oh, we've been trying to find you. We'd love to buy that story. So, yes, it was very exciting. I think I probably screamed and squealed and certainly jumped up and down. And so that was in a book called Shrieks, which was a feminist horror collection. And, it was an interesting book. And I went and did a reading up in Harold Park Hotel in Sydney. That was the very first live reading I'd done. And I still remember I was wearing a dress, and my husband told me later that I was okay from the top half up, but from the bottom down, my whole hem was shaking. I think my knees must have been shaking. I was so nervous. So he said that I looked fine, but he said that he could just see the hem of my dress was shaking with my knees.
Now, I know this is a tough question for any writer, because often it doesn't matter where you get to, you still sort of feel the same. But that was your first acceptance. But was there a point when you started to think, wow, I'm making it as a writer?
Oh, gosh, that's tricky, isn't it? I think that's probably when I started to, I didn't really get involved with the community for about 10 years after I started publishing, or probably about 12 years even, I think. The first convention I went to was one in Canberra. And that was the first time that I realised that people actually had heard of me. And that blew me away. Absolutely blew me away. They say, oh, you're Karen Warren. I'm like, wow, how do you know who I am? That was really weird. So it was probably then that I realised that people had read my work and remembered it. And I'd been on the Aurealis shortlist and that sort of thing before that. But that just seemed to happen somehow. And I mean, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I won one in 1998 before I knew anybody at all. But, yeah, I think it was probably then that I started to realise that people actually knew who I was and they were looking out for my work and that kind of thing. So that was one of the moments. There are many, I think, but that was one of them.
So what was it that led you to decide, was there any particular influences that you had growing up that you read and you wanted to write like them, or any role models in the community that you sort of looked up to that made you want to get to that level?
Well, I'd always read science fiction and horror. My dad is still a great science fiction reader, and that was the library that I had access to. So it was Harlan Ellison and Arthur C. Clarke, Ray Bradbury he always loved. It was all those sorts of things. So they were my very early influences, which I think have been very good influences, but probably influenced the way that I'm a slightly weirder writer rather than a straight writer, I suppose. And then my grandmother had a wonderful collection of books too, but hers was more the Daphne du Maurier and the Georgette Heyer, who were both absolutely wonderful writers as well. So they were both, Daphne du Maurier in particular was an incredible influence because she's just such an amazingly dark writer, but so human in what she's portraying. So yeah, I mean, still I sort of look at her and just think that, and her life story is fascinating too. I was reading about her life story from a young age as well, but I don't think I ever wanted to be quite as obsessive as she was in her writing. I always wanted to have that balance in my life, I think, a little bit more.
So did your writing just evolve organically, or did you go through any workshops or any mentor programs or anything like that?
I didn't do anything like that at all. I didn't do it at school. I didn't go to university. I went straight to work in advertising when I finished high school. I did a tech course in advertising, but then straight to work in advertising. I did one adult education type writing thing, which I didn't really enjoy very much. So yeah, no formal training at all. Just at high school, and I just always loved writing through high school. So paid a lot of attention to what the teachers were saying, I suppose. A lot more than most of the others were.
A lot more than I did too.
Yeah. I really loved it. I even loved the grammar and all that kind of thing. I was a bit of a English nerd. Not so much an English literature nerd. I used to not do so well in that because I always had my own interpretations and they didn't like that so much. They wanted to do as you were told. So. But English I absolutely loved.
Now, I think it's fair to say that you're one of the more internationally recognised Australian writers. It seems that sometimes it can be tough for Australians to sort of break out into the international scene. But, I mean, you've been recognised in some of the major international awards, like the World Fantasy Awards, the Bram Stoker, the Shirley Jackson Awards. And you've appeared on Locus lists and you're often in international anthologies. Other than being awesome, what do you think it is about your writing that resonates on an international level?
So it's a really good question, and I'm not exactly sure, because I think I do write very Australian stories. To me, my stories are really Australian, especially Sky, which is the one that recently had a lot of attention, the novella. To me, that's an incredibly Australian story with Australian vernacular and all that kind of thing. So it's not that I'm writing a non-Australian in a non-Australian voice. I don't know. It's a really good question. I know you had warned me that you were going to ask me this, and I haven't really managed to necessarily come up with the answer. I guess I look at very broad but very human themes in what I'm doing. Like I might have the settings that are Australian, the language which is Australian, but the stuff I'm looking at is the stuff that affects all of us, the emotional stuff and also the visceral responses that I evoke in my writing. Is the stuff that affects all of us. Like I sold one of my stories to a Polish best anthology. So it appeals to people in, you know, the European readers as well, which is really interesting. And I've got a couple of fans in Romania and, you know, there are people all over the world who do somehow get what I'm doing, which I think is interesting. And maybe it's because I do have those really human themes in what I'm looking at. I don't focus, and it's not the setting is important, but it's not the most important thing. What I'm trying to say and the themes that I'm looking at are the most important elements to the story.
Sounds like you're well on your way to world domination.
Well, I wish they could those plane trips would be good.
Yeah. So obviously, you're saying you've got fans in quite a few countries. Now, do you get fan mail? Do you get letters? What's the weirdest fan letter you've ever got?
I don't know that I've ever got them. I get comments on emails and things. I don't think I've ever really got anything weird. But then I don't think anything very much is weird. I'm pretty open minded. Like I tend to think that people can say almost anything and it's okay. I've never had anything aggressive, and I've been incredibly lucky. I have never had I've had negative comments about my work. I've had people who don't like it and people, I've had bad reviews, that sort of thing. That's absolutely fine, no issue. But I have never had a nasty word sent to me in the professional world, which is amazing, really. So very lucky that way. Probably more than I have people, and I'm probably the sort of person I am. I have people who feel like they're my best friend really quickly sometimes, and that's fine because I sort of feel that way a little bit myself. So, yes, but I don't think I've ever actually had a weird, I've certainly had no fingers sent in the mail or anything like that.
Well, in your case, it'd be more likely to have teeth sent in the mail, but
yeah, that's true, baby teeth. I do actually have a jar of baby teeth. I think I've told you about this before.
Oh, but please do tell everyone else about it.
Well, not my children's teeth.
Just random children's teeth?
Some teeth. Well, I was working for a science education magazine, and they were doing a study on baby teeth and the amounts of lead and cadmium, I think it was, and a couple of other things, to compare them to, I think it was children in Denmark had done the same thing. So I had to, and I've got a real phobia about teeth. They really do me in. Other people's teeth just freak me out. But I had to, as part of my job, these teeth would come in envelopes, and I would have to take them out of the envelopes and put them into little containers and label them, and it was really revolting. Some of them had come in with dirt from being buried in the backyard, so they'd been dug up. Some of them would come in with dental floss wrapped around them. But anyway, so, and then I would dutifully put them all into the little containers and send them all off, and they all, the study was done, and I don't remember what the results were. But these teeth kept coming in. I worked at this place for about 5 years. The teeth kept coming in for about 2 more years. And I never had the heart to just send them their teeth back. So I would send them a letter to say, thank you for your teeth, the studies, or whatever. And I kept them all. I didn't have the heart to just throw them out. So I've got all those little extra teeth in a little jar somewhere.
That's a very creepy story.
Well, it is. But the thing is, it's because I just, I felt, sorry for these little kitties sending their teeth in, and I didn't want to just throw the teeth out. So and the more I collected, the more I had to keep them. So that's the effect. Made its way into the opening of one of my stories, Dead Sea Fruit, because it is quite horrid. And some of them were not very. Some of them had lots of holes in them. Some of them had fillings. Gross.
So do you still have a phobia of teeth, or did that help you get over them?
It did help me get over them, because I did. Like, it really was hundreds and hundreds of other people's teeth I had to handle. So I think by the end of it, I was a little bit over it. But yeah, I wouldn't want to do it again.
I'm just imagining you turning up at an Aurealis Awards ceremony or something like that with this big necklace of teeth.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
That's actually
I'm not a big fan of teeth either. I don't know whether you saw the picture on Facebook of the x-ray of a child's skull with all the baby teeth still in there.
Oh, yeah.
Probably the most disturbing thing I've ever seen.
It shouldn't be. I don't know why, but yeah, there's just something about it.
So, moving on from that very vivid story, I was going to say, obviously, we're talking about how internationally your work has done really well. One of the big international anthologies that got a lot of publicity and a lot of submissions was Fearful Symmetries.
Mm.
So did you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh yes, well that was that's an amazing book, I think. I can't wait to see it. So yeah, there was Ellen Datlow, who rarely does the open submission, did put it open for that one. I think she got over 1,000 short stories to read, so or more, even more than that. I was one of the people that she had asked to submit, but that doesn't mean, of course, that she's going to take the story. So I felt incredibly under pressure on that one, and I'm sure everybody else who she'd invited to submit did as well. Because Ellen being, I know that when she takes, she rejects plenty of my stories. I know that if she takes a story, she really, really does like it. So, yes, I was under a lot of pressure, and I knew that she really wanted something super special, and it's going to be under a lot of the microscope, these stories that made it in, because I think she took 4 in the end from the 1,000. So really can't wait to read those ones, because they must be something pretty special. But Ellen doesn't. She's often has to do themed anthologies in what she does with a basic theme. So this one, I think she was really excited to actually do something that was broader than that. Just creep me out. Do what you want to do, but just creep me out.
So when you say that you felt under a lot of pressure with that, is that because there was so few open slots that you feel that there'll be a fair bit of scrutiny of the stories that weren't from submissions?
Yes, yeah, and there always should be. There always absolutely should be with anything that's produced, but I suppose in particular something from Ellen Datlow, because she's so renowned that people are always going to be looking to say, well, is it really that good? And I think they always are. I don't think I've ever read a bad story in an Ellen Datlow anthology. Some may be a different sort of taste to mine, not exactly what I would want to read, but I think they're always brilliant. Her years best are just incredible. I think the first one I read was probably about 20 years ago. And I just, it was one of those things. In fact, that's another one of those moments. You asked me earlier about the moments when I thought that I was being successful. When Ellen bought A Story of Mine for her year's best. Oh, I just, it was one of those things that I just thought was an impossible dream. Because I would read, and I would read them over and over. And I think I had about four or five of them. And then the rest I'd borrow from the library. Just incredible collections of stories, and what I would consider just the best horror that was being written. And when she actually took two of my stories over the last few years for those, that's astonishing. Interesting to see what does make it into people's imageries. And I think, I mean, it was more that I wanted to do her proud and do the book itself proud as well. I didn't want to feel like I was, you know, not doing the absolute most amazing story I could write.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it. It's going to be an incredible anthology, I think. Especially, obviously, coming from Ellen, it's always going to be at the top of the field, and having you in there is only going to make it better.
Okay, definitely. So,
obviously, you're doing a lot of stuff internationally, but I was very excited and interested to see you're involved with a new small press in Australia called Cohesion Press.
Yes, really good stuff that's coming out. It's Jeff Brown has set it up. He had an editing company as well, but he decided that he wanted to publish as well. And he's actually just announced his table of contents for Snafu, which is going to be military horror. I don't know if you saw that or were interested in that one, but yeah, I think he said he had close to 1,000 submissions for that, which is astonishing. So, yeah, he's just got his own brand of what he wants to do. And he had approached me to see if I had a novella for a reprint. He was doing electronic reprints. And I did have one, but then we started talking, and the more we started talking, we realised that how cool it would be for his first book to be a reprint collection of five of my stories, and that's what we ended up doing. And that was the Gate Theory. And I'm just really thrilled about it. Such a good chance to get some of these. So a couple of the stories were in very small press and didn't get seen, and so I'm really happy for them to get another chance to get out there and be seen again.
So was it tough narrowing it down to five stories? Did you have other ones that you would have liked to have seen reprinted there?
There's quite a few. I mean, I guess partly it was about recent stories, so ones that hadn't necessarily been collected, even though there's a couple that had been collected quite a few times, but we decided that was okay. And another couple that, yeah, just ones that hadn't been reprinted more than once. So. But, yeah, there's quite a few more that I would have liked to put in there, but I think five was just a good number. It was just a cohesive number. But he's a really motivated book. He's a good editor. He really knows what he's talking about, and it's great to work with people like him.
So did I see recently that you were in my old hometown area down near Arrowdale? Is that right?
Oh, I was, yes. Have you ever been there to the asylum?
Yeah, I have, very, very briefly. I grew up about an hour and a bit away from Ararat.
Which, oh, right.
Quite happy to be far away from it. It's got a very interesting atmosphere.
Yes. Well, it really sounds like quite a bizarre connection between the town and the lunatic asylum. The town really was strong and grew because of the lunatic asylum, because so many people worked there, and that's where a lot of the money came from. But then they also didn't like being known for it too, I suppose. Yes, now I went down. There was a writing workshop and creative weekend and ghost hunting weekend there a couple of weeks ago. So we actually slept over in the Arrowdale Asylum. It was fantastic. It was so good. It was very good. It's very grubby, very filthy, and there's no showers. We had to go down to the Ararat YMCA for our showers. So it was a bit like being back at school camp.
Yeah.
All the girls going with their toothbrush and their jammies to the, down to the bathroom together sort of thing. That was kind of fun. But we were ghost hunting at like 1 o'clock in the morning. They took us out and they had the equipment, the little machines, and the one that hears words and translates them and all that kind of thing. That was very good.
Any
ghosts? I did not see any ghosts at all, sadly. And I don't think I heard any. But my camera took a very weird photo. I don't know if you saw that on my Facebook.
No, no, I didn't.
Weird sort of shadowy thing there, which my daughter instantly said, oh, but Mummy, you're using a flash. So she instantly explained it away, yeah.
We might have to see if we can get that up on the Galactic Chat website, if that's okay. So.
Yes, no, definitely. Definitely we'll do that. Well, you can have the one my photographer fan very naughtily played with it and put another image in the window. So I'll put it both and you can see which one you like best.
Spot the difference.
Yeah, but it was really good. And inspiration, I think I ran a writing workshop there about how to use your dreams in your fiction, mostly hoping to stop people just waking up and writing down their dream and thinking that's the story, because there's nothing worse than reading a story that's just the dream written down. So, but I think it was really good, and they're all talking. There's about 10 people, and they've all said, they're all working away on their stories anyway. I've already seen drafts of a couple of them. We all got very inspired by being in this, by the terrible stories and the suffering that was there, and just the details that you can see as you're walking around, scratches on the door and all those sorts of things. We're all quite inspired by it.
I was reading some of the blog entries from the people who went on that trip, and some of it was a little bit creepy, I have to say. I don't know whether I would have been able to get to sleep.
Yeah, well, you know, there's some people really find it harder than others. There's some people, I think there's probably a few more slightly cynical people there, and that helped it not be scary. I think if you're there with people who are really, really, really believing in it, it would be a lot creepier. There was one bed there where a woman who'd been there the year before said that she'd been touched by a little girl in the night time in this bed. So she said, I'm not sleeping there again. And me and another woman looked at each other, and I'm like, oh, I can sleep there, and then she went, I'll sleep there. But you didn't feel anything. There was no. But there really, there's always that potential. You certainly do feel when you're there, there's always that possibility. And just to feel the place, and sitting there in the dark in hallways that have been empty for 30 years, and even just in that sort of mood, it can be very creepy. I mean, we did actually get locked into the high security area where they built for the homicidal maniacs, and the lock kind of fell off. And we got locked in there, and we had to call the other people up, and they couldn't get us out. But there was another door we could go over. We just had to try not to set off the alarm. So it wasn't drastic, but there was that sort of moment where we were saying, who's got the water? And I think one woman had 2 packs of anti-coal, and that was going to be the food for the night, sort of thing. Fabulous. It's just all the details. Like, it seems like they, and this is actually working its way into a story I'm writing now, a huge big pink peppercorn tree that they planted outside the morgue to absorb the smells. So it's just these little decisions that are made. You know, somebody put this little peppercorn tree in there early on, and it's now this huge big thing, and it was there so it wouldn't smell quite so bad.
So are you going to go back?
I think so, yeah. I think he'll organise another one. Jeff Brown actually organised it. He really loves it there. He's been 3 or 4 times, I think. Yeah, I would like to go back again. We actually did. We had a 7-hour tour of the place on the night we got there. Which was astonishing, the man who was taking us around. I mean, obviously some of the stories are a bit exaggerated, but it's just, you know, to move around from room to room and be told what happened where and what people have seen and all that kind of thing. It's very, very interesting. Tiring. Very good. Yeah, I'll definitely go back. I really enjoyed it.
So are there any other places that you've been to that you've found similarly inspiring as Aridale?
Oh, gosh, there's lots. There's lots. I'm really inspired by everywhere I go. There's one when I was, you probably know this one down in Melbourne, Montsalvat, which I went to when I was a really young kid. And it was probably one of the first places that I felt very disturbed by. And I haven't actually written this story yet, but it's one of these places where even then, I was probably about 12, I think, I knew this was the place I would write a story. And I've still got the notes somewhere about it. So that's one of them. Everywhere I go, when we were travelling in America, I was inspired by the trains and a bit of a mural in Philadelphia. It's anything that stands out, and even, you know, when I'm home in Canberra, I like to not cut myself off to what I'm seeing, even if it's just going for a walk or catching a bus and just being more observant for an hour or so, because you tend not to in your everyday life, don't you? You tend to go through your routine and not see anything beyond that routine, and so every now and then I try to wake myself up and see beyond the routine and notice what's around me again.
It's always interesting when you do put on that, I guess, the without sounding pretentious, but those rider's eyes where, you know, you start to, especially being down at the supermarket where you watch people going past and you make up stories or you think, how would a international terrorist break into that particular building or things like that? And
that's right.
See
yeah.
the world in a different way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's fun. You can't help the rider brain in those sort of times. The supermarket's huge material for me. You know, those people just looking what they've got in there. They can see what they've got in their trolley and seeing how they treat each other. And yes, people watching is really quite fascinating.
And why does that guy need bleach and garbage bags? And
yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, it's all in the guy that gets a bottle of metho and a bottle of cheap orange juice. And that just made me sad. I still remember that one. Or the guy, the one that I've never written a story about, but I've got a real thing about loneliness. You know, not solitude, because a lot of people absolutely love solitude, but loneliness. And the worst one was a man at the supermarket, I think it was Christmas Eve or a couple of days before, and he was buying himself just a little roll of pressed turkey. And I knew that was his Christmas lunch. And I nearly, like, I seriously nearly invited him for lunch at our place, but I knew the rest of the family would not have been impressed. So, yes. It's things like that. And it's just that emotion, like saving that emotion of that incredible sense of loneliness that I felt from him and saving that and using that when I want to have someone who is very lonely. Which I did actually in one of the stories in that Cartesian Press, The History Thief. That's about an incredibly lonely man who didn't live the life he thought he was going to live. And thinking back, probably a little bit came from that, seeing that man with his pressed turkey roll, where he started. Yeah.
It always really gets to me thinking that, you know, especially living in a city of 3 million where you can have that many people around, but then you can have people who are that lonely, just don't have any connections, and you sort of think, how can we let it be like that? But
yes. Yeah. Oh, I know. It's really hard. And as I said, a lot of people do choose it, and they absolutely, that's what they want, but there's plenty of others who really don't. It's sad. And we've all felt that, and probably because we've all felt that feeling as well. You felt like an outsider, or, you know, felt like you don't belong somewhere, and wishing you were with that group of friends who were having a great time and you weren't. It's a very human kind of thing to want to belong and want to be part of something, I guess.
See, there's some of those universal themes that you're writing about that are...
Yeah, that's right. I guess that's the sort of thing. That is exactly the sort of thing, because we can all relate to that. We can all relate to that sort of thing. Not making it too alien for other people, I suppose. And very rarely do I have my words changed. There was one just recently that was a reprint of a story where in it I say that someone cracked the shits. And it was an American editor, and they said, oh, we just wanted to check to make sure that's what you meant. And I said, yeah. And they didn't want to change it, though. They actually really loved it. They're probably using it themselves now, I think. But yeah, but they hadn't heard cracked the shits before.
Well, you've educated them. That's a very Australian saying.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I was thinking, didn't they, when they sent the car, you know, the movie The Castle, have you seen that one?
Yes.
When they sent that overseas, they changed a few Australianisms, and I always wonder how well some of our things translate. But
yeah, that's a shame, isn't it? You should have just sent them little cards with, you know, descriptions of what it meant or something. I don't know.
Or just put little subtitles underneath.
Oh, subtitles. Yeah, that seems like a shame.
And obviously, congratulations are in order at the moment, because you didn't just get one story on the Aurealis Awards shortlist, but two. That's very exciting. Did you want to tell us a little bit about the stories?
Oh, yes. No, I'm really excited about those two, actually. They're both really unusual stories, and it's nice to know that people read them and get them. The Human Moth is a completely bizarre story about a woman who really does think that she's a moth. And that was written for Joe Pulver's Grimscribe's Puppets, which is it's a great, really, really good collection. Actually, just made it onto the Stoker Awards, that anthology, sorry. And it was inspired, I was actually writing another story and doing lots of research about light and varieties of light and that kind of thing, and it came across a law, and I can't remember the exact name of the law now, but it's in Britain, and what it means is that you can't block somebody's light in. So if they've got a building, you can't build and take away their light. So I just got this image of somebody who's in their house, and their house is blocked in by buildings on all sides, and all their light is lost to them. And that's where Sig, the character sort of emerged with that. And that image ended up letting that bit go. I'll use that in another story. It became a different kind of story. But that's where the idea came from. Moths and light, and how would a moth who loves the light feel if all her light was taken away from her? It's a really creepy story, actually. It's one of the real nasty ones. But I think I captured her really well. I captured her exactly the way I wanted to capture her. Mm. So I'm glad to see that it's being understood or enjoyed. And the other one's Air, Water and the Grove, and that was written for another themed anthology by Pandemonium Press, who are in the UK doing amazingly interesting things. They published me in a Dickens story that was inspired by Dickens. That was another story they did of mine. And this one, we all got a different heavenly body to write a story about. And I ended up with Saturn. Well, I had the choice of Venus or Saturn. And I thought that Venus just, I don't know, it's a bit old, you know. Everyone's written stories about Venus and it was all a bit obvious. So I went for Saturn and just found so many interesting things about the melancholy that's associated with the planet and with the god, and absolutely fascinating stuff. So, and that's what I was trying to capture in this story. So it's a mother and son type story, and I really just explored the nature of that. But it's a science fiction. It's like a futuristic or slightly other world type story.
So what does the future hold? Are you working on any projects at the moment that you'd like to talk about, or are they all top secret?
Oh, some are secret. Some are secret. I've got a couple of short stories that I've got that I'm working on, finishing off this novel, which is nearly finished. Stories I've got coming out this year, and I'm not really quite sure what's announced. There's a Fearful Symmetries one, of course, and I'm trying to think what else there is. There's the one that I was working on for the Lights, which is a really bizarre anthology about I've gone blank on what it is. It's called, by Nate Peterson is the editor, so I'll have to look up and try and give you that. Yeah, I can give you the name of the book, but we all took a piece of a manuscript and had to try and explain it. It's very, very curious sort of piece of work. But always researching and always trying to figure out what the next magic clue to the next story is going to be, I suppose. That's what I'm trying to do at the moment. I'm working on a particular story and I haven't quite got that magic clue yet, but I'm nearly there. But the pepper tree is going to be a part of it.
So do you find that you start a story and all of a sudden there's just a point where it really hits its straps, where you feel that magic moment and the story takes off? Is that a very tangible point for you?
It usually is, yeah. Yeah, I've usually done a lot of thinking, a lot of note-taking, and sometimes even a first draft or a pile of notes or dot points written down. But there usually is that magic moment where I get that final bit that I need. Because I like to, it's always got to be layered. I don't like a story that's just the story itself. There's always got to be a theme there, and there's got to be other levels of meaning and a sense to it, I suppose. A particular kind of sense is what I'm going for, and a particular almost physical response that I need to have to my stories, and then I know I've got them right. I don't know if I've spoken to you about this before, but I actually have almost a physical response, and then I know that I've got something right. So I'm nearly there with this story because I've sort of got the smell of pepper in my nostrils. If I can almost smell the story, then I know that I'm nearly there with it. So I'm nearly there with this one. But it is usually that magic moment when I finally get that last little bit of the puzzle. Even if it's a character thing, if it's an element of the character that I didn't have, or the character backstory, which may not be in the story but helps me understand who they are a bit more. The character motivation sometimes doesn't always work until I've thought about it really hard and many, many times, but that's really important. I can't finish a story until I'm sure that the character's motivations are clear to me, even if they're horrendous and horrible and whatever, they still need to make a certain sort of sense. Yeah, I tend to do lots of research, which is interesting anyway. And was inspired by my stay at Arrowdale, so there's a certain element of that coming into it. And I think actually a little bit of the novel that I'm working on is creeping in as well, so I've got to make sure not too much creeps in. I don't mind a little bit of crossover, but not too much. Yes. Now, the one I forgot that I've got coming up, which is really exciting, is I've got a story in Shadows and Tall Trees, which is Michael Kelly's, the Canadian editor. He'd been asking me for a story for absolutely ages, and then I wrote this one, and it was just perfect, called Death's Door Cafe. So I'm very excited about that one. I think that's a couple of months out. Yes. It's all very good. So when you can make someone happy, is it after you finish your story, and then you finally get them something, and they love it, and you go, yes.
Well, it certainly sounds like you've got a lot of exciting things coming up, so I'm sure that everyone will be following with interest, and we'll have your website details up on the Galactic Chat website so people can check it out. But I'm sure that most of them have heard of you already because you're doing some wonderful things.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
But thank you very much for joining me tonight. It's been a really interesting conversation, so thank you.
Oh, thanks, David. It's been excellent.